Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. My co-host tonight is Emmy-nominated NBC legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Dean.
Good evening, everyone. You know, in our last two episodes, we've asked the question, are the guardrails coming off in America and in the Bay Area? We asked our guests and our listeners whether all those problems that make listening to the news these days a traumatic experience, problems like the pandemic, the insurrection, inflation, soaring crime rates, random violence against ethnic minorities, police shootings, vigilante justice, flash and grab mobs, and homelessness, are just a perfect storm of bad news? Or is there something deeper going on? Are all of these things connected? Are the social norms that used to hold our society together disintegrating? Jeff?
In our first episode, we talked to sociologist Andy Barlow and political scientist Lawrence Douglas, each of whom opined that we're not merely seeing a breakdown in behavior, but the result of people who no longer believe in the rule of law. Our listeners told us in no uncertain terms that they wanted to hear from people on the front lines of the struggle in the Bay Area, those with boots on the ground. So in our second episode, we spoke to community leaders and activists, attorneys Damone Hale and Kevin Allen, along with Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley and Santa Clara County District Attorney Jeff Rosen, all of whom talked about the need for revival of the institutions that hold the guardrails in place, family, church, school, the courts, and especially the community. Tonight in our final episode in the series, or perhaps the next to last episode in the series, we want to flip the narrative and talk about solutions more than problems and where there might be emerging some light at the end of the tunnel. Dean?
Yeah, you know, our listeners wanted to talk to the powers that be, the people who have or who aspire to have power in the Bay Area, and to ask them the hard questions. How did we get into this predicament? And what do you plan to do about it? Tonight, we want to extend a personal invitation to our listeners to join this conversation. We're going to be asking a question or two to you, just like we ask questions to our guests. And we want to hear from you. We want to know what you think should be done if you were one of the powers that be. What would you do on your first day in office? Jeff.
So give us a call. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, call us at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. But remember, just as a doctor can't diagnose your family member based on a phone call, our attorney guests can't provide you with legal advice about a particular case, but they're here to help. Tonight, we want to put questions to you, our listeners. The questions for tonight, some of our guests occupy positions of power or have been looking at things for a long time. If you were elected to a position in leadership, what would you do on your first day in office? And Charles, I'll ask you, if you were elected to become the next county supervisor, what would you do? Dean?
And tonight, in addition to our listeners, we have a stellar panel of guests who are among the movers and shakers in politics in the Bay Area. Jeff, who's our first guest?
Santa Clara District Attorney Jeff Rosen joined us last week via pre-recorded interview. Happily tonight, he joins us here as part of our panel. Mr. Rosen heads the San Francisco Bay Area's largest prosecution team, serving a population of nearly 2 million people. Dean?
And Charles Stone is a practicing attorney, mayor of the city of Belmont, and currently a candidate for San Mateo County Supervisor.
And as Charles would be quick to jump in, former mayor of Belmont, he's currently a council member and also sits on boards for a lot of the other entities, such as the San Mateo County Transit District. Also joining us, Mark Simon is a political writer who for nearly three decades has focused on the Bay Area. He currently writes for the San Mateo Daily Journal. And to all of you, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Great to be here tonight, Jeff and Dean.
Happy to be here.
So, Jeff Rosen, I know that you have to leave the show a little early to honor some other commitments. So we're going to start with you. Last week, we were talking about the rise in crime in the Bay Area. And you explained very eloquently that crime, in a lot of ways, has become more organized in the Bay Area than ever before. Silicon Valley is the home of innovation, and innovation in crime is no exception. Is the reason for the increase in crime in our area that the criminals are just more organized or more sophisticated, or is there just more opportunity to commit crime here?
Well, thank you very much for that question, Dean. I think the increases that we've seen in crime over the last year are based on a few different factors, and it's always hard to know how much to weigh each factor. But certainly coming out of the pandemic, as we stopped sheltering in place and began to be able to leave our houses and go about our lives, the same happened with criminals, then had more of an opportunity to commit crimes. So one is coming out of the pandemic. Number two, we have huge inequities in our society between rich and poor. And as those inequities increase, we may see, I think part of that has led to increases in crime. And three, I do agree with what your sociologist guest said a few weeks ago. There has been somewhat of a weakening of institutions like family, churches, Rotary clubs, PTAs, places where people gathered together to do positive things for their community. And in Silicon Valley, the home of innovation, criminals have innovated as well and become more organized, organizing themselves quickly online, sharing information, and engaging in some very public smash and grab retail robberies over the last several weeks, which very concerned me. You know, when I watched these happening on television, it really made me angry. And I immediately began asking my staff what we were doing to try to catch the people that were involved, hold them accountable, and what we were doing to try to prevent or deter this kind of crime in the future.
You know, it almost sounds like there's a paradox here that we're experiencing in the Bay Area. And for our other guests, jump in on this discussion as well, that we are lucky enough to enjoy great success and great wealth in this area. Certainly big tech has brought us a lot of wealth and a lot of great innovations. But is there a paradox going on here where that great wealth also creates great poverty? I mean, there are a lot of people out there who at one point were middle class and could afford housing, and now housing is almost unaffordable. And the people who were already poor are now falling off the cliff. And that may be one of the reasons that we now, when we go, say, to the federal courthouse in San Francisco, we literally have to step over people who are shooting up all kinds of drugs to get into the courthouse. Is that perception accurate, or do you guys have a different perception of it?
Well, I think as Jeff alluded to, you know, there's an increasing divide, both nationwide, but especially here in the Bay Area. You can be well off by national standards, but still struggling in the Bay Area. And if you're beneath well off, it becomes increasingly hard the lower income you are. If you're on the bubble of being without a home, you're unstable with regard to housing, for instance. All it takes is losing one job in a two-income household, or not having certain amount of luck go your way, and the next thing you know, you're living in an RV or on the street.
Let me jump in as a reporter role and ask Jeff. I think there's a general sense, why aren't you, not you specifically, but why aren't people cracking down on this? And rather than put the question to you quite that way, What are the cross currents that make that difficult?
That's a really good question, Mark. On the one hand, there is great desire for criminal justice reform in our state and for using tools in addition to incarceration to treat crime. So there's broad public support for things like mental health treatment and drug treatment instead of throwing people in jail for crimes that are caused by those offenses. At the same time, we've significantly reduced our jail population, our state prison population, but we haven't increased things like housing significantly. And anyone living on the street for any substantial amount of time, if they were mentally sound before living on the street, after living on the street for a few weeks or a few months, they're going to have mental illness problems. They're going to have drug problems. It's just a very difficult place to live and to survive. So I think on the one hand, we want criminal justice reform, but we also want things to be safe. And I think that there maybe is a correction beginning in terms of criminal justice, in terms of DA's offices and our courts, that, we need to protect the public first and foremost. Without that, we can't do any reforms. Let me just say it this way. I've always believed that the public's appetite for criminal justice reform depends on their perception of crime. If people feel safe, then they're okay with experimenting and trying more treatment. When they don't feel safe, they want people locked up. And so I think those are the cross currents that we're in the midst of right now.
Yeah, Jeff, let me ask you a question I've just been dying to ask. The other day, I was sitting in court in San Jose, and it occurred to me that maybe our approach to criminal justice has been wrong all along. You know, we talk about more incarceration, longer sentences, better law enforcement, and that all seems to assume that criminals are rational decision makers, that they make this calculation between what's the chances of my getting caught versus what am I going to gain by committing this crime? And those of us like Jeff Hayden and I and you, from our day-to-day experience, we know that people who commit crimes are the worst decision makers in the world. They're anything but rational decision makers. Should our approach be entirely different? Should we be giving people the support and the background to make better decisions and possibly the wherewithal to implement those decisions instead of focusing on more and deeper and more intense law enforcement and incarceration?
So I agree that most individuals that commit crimes are not rational or good decision makers, and they would be much better off if they simply got a job and worked. They would be able to provide for themselves better than going out and committing crimes and trying to make money from that. I think that what we want to try to do, the message I want to try to send as the DA to our whole community is this message. If you commit a crime, you are likely to be caught quickly and held accountable. Now that accountability, whether that's 5 days in jail, 5 months in jail, or 5 years in prison, is not as important as people understanding that they will be caught quickly and held accountable or punished quickly. And so, I think it's important for us to spend more money on the front end in law enforcement, which is police officers. That's cheaper than spending money on the back end in terms of jails and prisons. So that's how I think about it. I also would just add that what we're doing in criminal justice is not just directed at people that are thinking of committing crimes. We're trying to tell the whole community that we have these laws and standards, we uphold them, and people who break them will be caught and held accountable. And that's an important message to send to the vast majority of our community who never commits crimes. We want them to have confidence in law enforcement and in their criminal justice system. So that's another reason I want to make sure that people are held accountable for committing crimes.
One of the things that, well, I've noticed that as in your conversation just now, you've been focusing on things which our voters, our leaders have decided as matters of policy. Tell us a little bit about the effect of what the COVID pandemic has done to your ability to make these plans and to put things in an orderly way. We know early last year, most of the jails in the state released an awful lot of people. We've had COVID outbreaks that make it very difficult to get people through the system, people that have been released early from prison, and officers that don't necessarily want to have long encounters with people because they don't want to get sick either. Is that something we can account for?
I do think that COVID has, in some ways, positively and in some ways negatively affected crime. So early in the pandemic, back in, you know, March, April, May of 2020, when the society was really locked down, crime did go down. Most categories of crime went down. But then as we opened back up, crime went back up. It's very frustrating for me, the delays that we're experiencing in the criminal justice system, cases that are lagging for years because we're not able to try those cases. And it frustrates me for a number of reasons. One, I want there to be the accountability and justice for the defendants and also for the victims of the crime and our community. And we have a big backlog in our county, as most counties do. And, you know, we're just starting to try more cases when we had this last variant of Omicron. And I hope this is the last one and we're able to, you know, more quickly handle cases. It is true that justice delayed is justice denied for everyone involved.
I'm not even, I hate to be a pest about this, but I guess that comes with my profession. I don't know if people feel safe just because you're arresting people for crimes. I mean, I think about some of the conditions in San Francisco where someone's shooting up on the street. Maybe that's not a crime. I don't know. I'm not sure what a crime is anymore, to be honest with you. But certainly that makes me feel unsafe. And I think you look around everywhere on the peninsula, everywhere in the Bay Area, there are massive homeless encampments that theoretically are not necessarily breaking felonies, certainly not committing felonies, although there may be felons in there. But they're not. It's contributing to that general sense that things aren't safe.
Mark, I completely agree with you. I think that while I can, you know, tell you the data and what crimes are going up or down in my county from year to year, I know that what matters more than that is how people feel. And I agree that very near my office, there's a huge homeless encampment. There's homeless people in front of my office when I come in the morning. And it makes me feel terrible, and it does not make me feel safe. And certainly I've been to San Francisco and I've walked around there when people are shooting drugs up, and it makes me concerned for my safety. I mean, of course it makes me sad and a lot of things, but it does make me feel unsafe, and it does contribute to that feeling. And so, you know, in order for people to feel more safe, I think what we understand is, you know, everybody needs a place to live. Everybody, and we would feel a lot safer if people were housed. And honestly, I want to stress this point. If people had a house, a place to go, and they were shooting up and using drugs in their house, okay, that's, I feel bad for that as a human being. But as the DA, focused on public safety, it's not affecting how I or other people feel about it. Part of how this affects people's feelings is that it's out in the open. And so I really, it's hard to get more housing anywhere, but particularly in the Bay Area. But that to me is the place to start to help people feel safer and to help people ultimately.
Jeff, before you go, I know the time is very tight for you. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing to help counter some of the growing intelligence and communications ability of some of these folks?
Yes. So while criminals are becoming more and more organized and using the internet and social media to do that, I want people to know that law enforcement is even more organized, frankly. And in our county and across the Bay Area, we meet continuously to share intelligence about criminal gangs and organized retail robberies that are happening in cities all over our communities here. And that intelligence is shared in real time and allows us to solve more of these crimes more quickly. And even more importantly than that, deter crimes from being committed. For example, when we know that there's a car and a group of people associated with committing retail robberies in San Jose, and that car drives up to Redwood City and drives by the Hillsdale Mall in Redwood City, immediately the Redwood City police are alerted about that car. And that can help to deter those individuals and prevent them from committing crimes in Redwood City, and frankly leads to them getting arrested. So while it's a cat and mouse game, the law enforcement team is more organized, smarter, and frankly more dedicated.
Before I would go, all I would say is that.
Honestly, when I see the smash and grab robberies on television, my first thought and my first emotion is I'm pissed off and I want to find out who did it and I want to hold them accountable and I don't want them to do and I want to lock them up for a while so they don't do it again. That's my thought process.
Anything you wanted to say in closing before you go?
Honestly, the next meeting I have is to fight crime in my county. So that's what I'm going to, that's what the meeting's about. So thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it talking with all of you.
Thank you for joining us. If you have just a moment, we have a caller on the line. I don't know if her question's addressed to you or not. If you have a moment.
Sure.
Tara from Burlingame, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for the show. I'm a kindergarten teacher. I live in Burlingame. And I wanted to bring up the concept that the research has proven that high-quality learning is one of the most powerful weapons against crime, while poor early childhood experiences multiplies the risk that the children will grow up to be criminals. And as a society, I've always been surprised that we don't invest more in both offering that to children as well as paying for quality teachers. So this is more of a preventative question maybe than your guest can address, but I just wanted to raise that issue to your listeners. Thank you.
That's a great question. And there's an organization called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids that myself and a number of other police chiefs and prosecutors are involved in. And really to your point, early learning, incredibly important. But one of the statistics that I know very well is a 10% increase in the high school graduation rate leads to a 20% reduction in violent crime. So in my county, if we can increase the high school graduation rate 10%, we will have a dozen fewer murders and hundreds of fewer robberies and violent assaults. So I completely agree with you, and that's why it's very important for me that kids are in school, that they're learning and that they graduate, because then they're going to become productive citizens. And if they don't graduate from high school, there's a really high likelihood that they're going to end up committing crimes and go to jail.
I think there's no doubt, and it really can't be argued, that if we can attack the root causes of having a world-class education, mental health reform, poverty, and housing those who are not housed, Jeff will have a lot less to do.
Good night.
Good night, Jeff. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Good night.
And then there were three. So I'd like to turn it to Mark and to Charles for what you've just heard. If you want to do any follow-up to Jeff's comment. I mean, to me, the obvious is, have we reached the point where criminal justice reform isn't working? Have we reached a point where the pandemic has just thrown a wrench into all these plans? What do you think is happening? Charles?
Couple things. I'm going to push back a little bit on the narrative with regard to San Francisco. You know, it's certainly not fun to always visit the city these days, but I do trust my 18 and 16-year-old daughters to go up there during the day by themselves, friends, and it's easy to forget historical context. You know, I read a book called Season of the Witch over the summer, and it reminded me of things like the Zodiac Killer, the Zebra Killer, and a time where the murder rate in San Francisco was double, triple what it is now. And while we don't like to see the things that we see, I'm not sure San Francisco is less safe than it was before. And I think it's fair to note that. In terms of what's going on, I think it's a confluence of factors. We've got an incredibly high cost of living. We've got well-meaning programs that don't get the results we hoped for. The Lanterman Petras Short Act, may or may not need to be reformed. There's a lot of difficulty in getting someone help that doesn't want help, whether we're talking about addiction or mental health, and often we're talking about both. And it's probably past time to revisit how we really want to handle these issues if we expect better outcomes. You know, streets flooded with cheap, highly addictive fentanyl is a huge issue, and it's overwhelming our systems. And so criminal reforms, sure, we need to talk about those. Systemic injustices, we need to talk about those. But we've also got to be concerned with attacking the root causes.
You know, you mentioned pushback on the San Francisco narrative. I'd like to throw this back to you. I don't think we'll have a chance to finish it before we break for station ID. But I'd like to take a step back. You mentioned San Francisco. San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin is one of the leading voices in favor of criminal justice reform, certainly in this region, one of the leaders in that movement. And at present, he's the subject of a recall effort, which is in large part because of some of those reforms that he speaks of. Although I think what people are seeing is in large part a result of decisions and policies that predated his being in office. But to that extent, to the extent that his detractors are blaming his policies for a recent uptick in crime, I want you to think a little bit about that and about whether that's fair, whether criminals become emboldened when they think that the police or the DA's office are soft on crime. For that matter, when you have an area which is perceived as soft in crime, rightly or wrongly, such as San Francisco, does it make this area a magnet for people coming in from other parts of the Bay Area or even beyond that are looking for a safe place to conduct their activities? We have about a minute left. Do you want to jump in on this one, Mark?
Well, the question is, does it have to be an either-or proposition, or can it be a both-and? And I think that's the challenge. I know from talking to people in San Francisco politics that the DA there is getting a bum rap, that the data from his office showing crime data is not as bad as it seems. And the fact is, in San Francisco, if he cracked down on the homeless and drove them out the way Rudy Giuliani drove them out of New York, he could easily get recalled by another group of people who were unhappy with that. So some of it is just the nature of politics in San Francisco. I want to get onto this a little bit more, but I also think I want to go back to the caller's point, which is that schools, and we talk a lot about housing, we don't talk as much about schools and what needs to be done there. And I know Rip Van Winkle could be awakened out of a 100-year slumber, walk into any grammar school in California, and feel right at home. Schools are structured and taught almost exactly the same way they were when I was in grammar school. And I just can't believe that we haven't made some significant changes there, including, of course, paying people better.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. A few weeks ago, we asked the question, are the guardrails coming off? Tonight, we're joined by tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst Dean Johnson, and guests, District Attorney Jeff Rosen of Santa Clara County, attorney, former mayor of Belmont, Charles Stone, a supervisorial candidate in San Mateo County, and political writer Mark Simon, who has been on the scenes writing about Bay Area goings-on for some three decades. Who better to discuss such troubling developments? Why, that would be you, of course. If you have questions for my guests or wish to briefly share your experiences, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Dean, you had something lined up?
Yeah, I want to ask a bigger question that follows up on what D.A. Rosen had to say and what our caller had to say and sort of what we've been talking about all this hour. And it's a question I've wanted to ask for a long time. You know, statistics show that America represents 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's assets, which means on the average, we have about five times the assets per capita of most countries in the world. We clearly have the resources to solve all of the problems that Jeff was talking about, that Tara was talking about, ignorance, poverty, disease. The question is, for Mark, who spent four decades in politics, and Charles, who occupies a public office, why aren't we doing that? Is there a leadership gap in America? And if so, how do we fill that gap?
Well, I'll jump in. You know, it's not so much always about resources as political will and possibility. Right. There are many people who don't agree, even within bands of agreement at a sub level, on how to handle a given problem. And that's the challenge we have in a participatory democracy. So we can talk about, you know, schools, for instance. I have 10 friends that at varying levels have some degree of expertise, whether it's in the classroom or from an administrative level, and they'll all give you 10 different answers about how we fix these problems. I was thinking about this the other day because I was contemplating what it takes to get us out of this kind of political rut we're stuck in this country. And I was thinking about a couple things. You know, in my childhood, you would hear about Blue Ribbon Task Force that were at least ostensibly apolitical. You don't hear about that as much. And, you know, things like the tax reform of the 1980s required people to cross the aisle and work together. So I think it's not necessarily a matter of leadership crisis as it is a matter of, and I think these are some of the things we might talk about later, just the current moment of the day and what it drives political leaders to do rather than to be focused on, you know, working with one another for good results, even if maybe it doesn't get you all the clicks and likes from your constituents. You know, there's an old quote that politics is the art of disappointing your followers at a rate they can't absorb. I guess these days I question what rate can they absorb, because we see folks very quickly after someone gets elected, and I've experienced this myself, turn on the folks that they supported just a few days, weeks, months, years before in sometimes venomous fashion.
Yeah, but, you know, other countries manage. I mean, the example I always point out is China and India. China's an authoritarian government. India is a country that is a democracy, but probably shouldn't be. It's got 25 different languages, 60 different political parties. It should be almost ungovernable. But both countries have raised something like 300 million people out of poverty, more than the population of America itself. But why can't we, with all of our resources, manage to do something like that? What, you know, what's the flaw in the system right now?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues there that are, we're living in a time of transition. I'm convinced that we're seeing the end of dominance of American politics by white males. So when people sense they're losing power, they fight harder to hold on to it, often to an extreme. And you're seeing some of that now. But the transition is taking place. The diversification of the communities that Charles and I live in. I read in the Chronicle the other day, there's a zip code in San Mateo at Hillsdale, where the Hillsdale Shopping Center actually is, that there are 90 different countries, residents from 90 different countries in that one zip code. There's over 60% of the people in San Mateo County are people of color. I think the political transition is coming, and it's going to be messy. It's going to be difficult. It's going to require people to give to cede power when they don't want to. I also think the economy moves even more slowly. But Charles can probably talk about this better than I can. There is a growing surge of progressive candidates who talk openly about wealth distribution, who talk openly about free child care, who talk about housing, more housing, and support some of the legislation in Sacramento that would essentially force communities to be more open-minded about multiple-use, multiple-unit properties. The people you hear from are the people who have lived there a long time, like us, who have a house and don't want to lose what we've got. But that transition is inevitable. The only question is, how long will it take and how much chaos and damage will there be done along the way?
Fran from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Thank you. I would like to get back to my radio update. I want to get back to the local San Francisco issue on crime. I live here for 30-something years. In brief, I've seen and been through, and I'm going through a lot of changes in regard to everything we're talking about here. The answer on softness of crime in punishing in San Francisco for people coming in from outside, I was in front of a Walgreens several months ago. There was a policeman there, and we were talking because it was a Chase of Badoon thing where the petition is going around, and I was considering whether I wanted to sign it. And I asked him, you know, up front, what's going on here. He said very simply that these people are all taking advantage of the softness on crime and coming in together and, you know, in their gangs and bunches are coming in very specifically to San Francisco as a target. Why, he said, the policeman, that it is because they're not being arrested, you know, they're not being punished. They know they can get away with it. And we are being, you know, to me, police reform would be on violence, on personally, on policemen being too violent. That's what I think police reform should be more about right now, but they're being definitely too reformed, and I believe their hands have been tied in politically. So thank you, and I appreciate your program.
Thank you for joining us. And before I move on, I wanted to ask if either Mark Simon or Charles Stone wish to comment on what Fran just told us. From the perspective of somebody who lives here in the city.
You know, I think we covered that fairly well, I believe, with Jeff Rosen, which is, if there was one single solution, I think everybody would have turned to it by now. Nobody likes to hear this, but it's a complicated problem. And there are competing forces. There are political forces in San Francisco that have a commitment to some of the housing issues the way they are. There are people, you know, the Board of Supervisors voted to support the mayor's crackdown on crime in the Tenderloin and then revisited it because they weren't sure that they were comfortable with the freedoms they gave the police to enforce some of the laws there. And I don't know how you weave your way through that. I really don't.
Yeah, you know, Mark, I'd like to follow up on something you said before. You're talking about a progressive movement, explicitly talking about redistribution of wealth. And we've spoken a little bit about how big tech has brought so much innovation and so much wealth into the Bay Area. And paradoxically, put people who were previously in a fairly good position in positions of poverty. Is it time for government to take on big tech? I mean, from the legal standpoint of, you know, antitrust and all of the other potential violations of law, and also from the legislative perspective of taxing companies like Netflix and Amazon that paid zero taxes last year, or Apple that tripled its value to a $3 trillion company in the last 4 years. Should we do that, or are we killing the goose that laid the golden egg?
Well, I think the real answer, as a reporter, I don't want to say whether we should or we shouldn't. What I would say is the kind of stalemate that we see is exactly over that issue. There are people, you know, in equal capacities in our federal legislature who have diametrically opposed views about the creation of wealth and what it takes to hold on to it. So I think that's the challenge. That being said, I think there will be efforts both legislatively and through the legal process to rein in Facebook and Google and some of those other people. And since I got a couple of attorneys handy, one of the things I think has already happened, when they began removing posts on their platform because they violated a standard they had, I believe they stopped behaving as though they were a platform and began behaving as a publisher. Before, they were a conduit for the information they were getting, and they said, we take no position on what is being said. That has changed in the last 2 years. And because of that, I think at some point in the future, there's a landmark libel suit waiting to be filed against Facebook or Google, essentially by someone who was slammed on one of their platforms. And Google's argument that we're not responsible for that will not survive. That's my view of it anyway.
I suspect somebody is crafting that argument as we speak, or already has. I want to get back to the taxes question for a second, because I think the issue is a little more nuanced than it's often made out to be. And I certainly think truly rich and large, incredibly profitable companies need to pay their fair share in federal taxes. That said, these large tech companies do pay a lot of other kinds of taxes, property, sales, use, etc., that are often overlooked when these discussions are had. And that certainly has helped the economy in the Bay Area and helped governments in the Bay Area. I think it's time we had wholesale federal tax reform, but as I mentioned earlier, we saw in the 80s, you need rational actors on both sides of the aisle willing to compromise, and that ship, at least presently, seems to have sailed.
Nicholas from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had kind of an opinion about, I think that we're kind of underestimating the amount of like anger and apathy that the extreme inequality creates amongst like normal working class people in the city. Like, for instance, the Louis Vuitton smash and grab or the Walgreens things were the two like most popular news stories. And to me, I'm a normal law abiding citizen. I'm a teacher. But when I see like a company like a luxury goods company storefront like Louis Vuitton getting broken into, or a Walgreens that there's like 100 of them in the city and they pay their employees so low that they can't even afford to live in the city. And I see that and I'm kind of like, good. Like, I don't really care about them. So I just wanted to bring that perspective to the table.
Thank you. Do either of my guests, any of my guests care to comment on that? Kind of a eat the rich.
Well, I don't know about that. I do think there is a lot of anger, and that's why people can't talk to each other. You know, some of that comes with being in a time of uncertainty, which is what a time of transition is. But I think there is a lot of disconnection, dislocation. People feel like they're not being seen or heard or represented. There are two extremes that tend to dominate the political debate in this country. I think there's a lot of people in the middle. There's also this idea that when you are disenfranchised, when you are disaffected, it is now much, much easier to find someone who can agree with you. And that's because of the social media environment we're in, where you used to be just some guy who complained or maybe showed up at a city council meeting with tinfoil in your hat. Now they all find each other and there are more of them together, and it reinforces their notion that I'm not in this alone, that in fact, I represent everybody and everybody agrees with me, everybody I talk to. So therefore, I must be right and the system is screwing me over.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, I certainly am empathetic and sympathetic when I hear folks talk about not feeling heard. If there's one thing I've learned in 8 years on a city council and in other positions, it's that people get very angry when they don't feel heard. And how we listen as leaders and as a society is hugely important to whether or not we can kind of finally find an inflection point and sort of climb out of this hole of a lack of civil discourse and progress that we found ourselves in.
You know, it's clear that not everybody's on the same page as Mayor Breed and as far as there's emergency crackdown in the Tenderloin. My understanding is that the district attorney, Chesa Boney, just came out against it as well. But let me turn it to Caitlin from San Francisco, as time is short, and I want to put you through. Caitlin, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I didn't prepare anything. I literally just called in after hearing the last speaker because I kind of feel like the responses were a little lackluster. Yes, everyone is in disagreement and unsure of what to do, but we're talking about extreme wealth inequality. And that's not just everyone's got an argument. That is a problem that needs to be addressed. And it's kind of ridiculous that our city programs, our government, and our news media outlets are spending so much time crying about Louis Vuitton when there are thousands and thousands of homeless people out on the street. And, you know, it's just like our priorities don't feel like they're in alignment with what is morally and ethically valuable for human life. And I just kind of felt like that response was just a little too lackluster for me regarding that issue, because it's not just like, oh, eat the rich. It's more than eat the rich. It's like, This is the symptom of a much deeper systemic issue, that we don't care about things that do not provide wealth for, and not for the majority of us, but for a very few of us. That's really all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, Caitlin, if I can respond to that, I'll tell you something I was thinking about on the way to court today. Now, there was a case a few years ago in the Supreme Court called Citizens National, where they said corporations are people, too. And I was thinking, yeah, corporations are people, too, but people are also people. And maybe we ought to treat our people as well as we treat our corporations. If we think that we as individuals should be paying taxes for our fair share of public goods, then corporations massively use public goods 100, 1,000, a million times more than we individuals do. So they should be paying their fair share for the use of those public goods. On the other hand, if corporations are going to get a deduction for business investments, shouldn't we who invest in ourselves by getting an education get a tax deduction for that as well? I mean, if corporations are people, let's put them on equal footing. And that may be the answer to our wealth distribution problem.
You know, if I could just chime in for a second, too, in response to Caitlin, I definitely hear what she's saying. But I don't think the response has been lackluster. You've seen cities in the Bay Area do things that traditionally were the role of the state and the federal government. For instance, raising the minimum wage over the last several years. In 2016, San Mateo raised the minimum wage to higher than the state level, and is now at $16.20 per hour. Belmont followed suit the following year, and we are now at $16.20 per hour. And while that's certainly not a living wage in the Bay Area, it's a heck of a lot better than where we were headed, and hopefully we'll stave off some of the problems that the stagnation in the minimum wage, both at the state and federal level, have caused. You've also seen increasing willingness and leaders who speak about building affordable housing. And we're actually seeing that happen. Truly affordable housing is being built. Is it being built as fast as it should be? Absolutely not. Is it being built in the quantities it should be? Absolutely not. But it is starting to get built. The state is paying attention. So I think that here in the Bay Area and in California, while we're not doing enough, we're doing more than a lot of places are. And so I certainly don't want to paint with too rosy a brush, but I will say that I don't see lackluster. I see folks who are engaged in trying to make it better. It's just a question of resource allocation, help from the state, and finding that magic silver bullet where you can get enough support from everyone to do enough to move the needle.
You know, one thing I think deserves mentioning is that, Caitlin, you're having this discussion on a station which is one of the very few in the region that are fostering discussions such as this and are talking about chronic problems such as homelessness on a regular basis and are really open to solutions and asking for your input. Most of the media is dominated by commercial media. They're out to sell ads, have people tune in, and turning the camera towards a mob of people who are breaking into a store where things are very genteel brings people to watch television, to listen on the radio, to hear their ads. That's the nature of commercial media. So, yes, you're not going to hear as much shock and awe about long-term chronic programs, long-term chronic problems in our region over commercial media, as perhaps you should. So to that extent, I agree with you. Mark, I see you added something you wanted to say also.
Well, I, you know, in the spirit of the show, which was supposed to be, is there any positive news? I do think the transition that I've been talking about at the beginning is a reality. And if you're feeling as a person of color that you're not represented adequately, I think that will change over time. Maybe not in this election cycle. There are a huge number of political seats up for grabs on the peninsula. Charles is running for an open seat. There's another open seat on the Board of Supervisors, as well as the congressional seat and an assembly seat. That's very unusual, but I think it probably will not be as unusual. There have been some really significant reforms. Almost every city in San Mateo County has adopted district elections, which will dramatically changed the makeup of some of these local city councils. They're all adopting campaign donation limits. San Mateo County pioneered mail-in voting, which means everybody votes. And we talked before the show off the air. I think it does change the universe of who participates. These are all changes that are going to have a profound effect. And even reapportionment, redistricting, which was done largely by independent commissions. Somebody's political ox got gored. But that's the nature of it. The difference is somebody else's political ox didn't feed at the trough while somebody else had to go home. So there are a lot of reforms taking place that will hasten the political changes that I think are coming.
Let me turn it to Stephen in San Francisco. You're on Your Legal Rights. I will let you know time is very, very short, but I want to give you about a minute.
Okay. I'm interested in the playing the Asians against the blacks, as was done at Lowell High School. I have friends who are Asian, and their children were kept out of being able to really compete to get into Lowell High School because of the removal of a test which would have only allowed those students who studied hard and worked to get into the school. And once they removed that, and it worked into a system which was not based on competence, a lot of the Asian students were, kept out from getting in. And this is like playing one race against the other. And yet I have not heard really much from the newspapers, nor from the city council, the Board of Supervisors, about this type of situation. I hear people talk about it privately, but I don't hear it really discussed publicly. What do you think about that?
Well, let me cut. I hate to cut you off, but we are out of time. But Stephen, I do welcome the chance to talk with you further. It's a bit off tonight's topic, but it is something that I'm very interested in chatting with you about. can't do it on tonight's show. We're unfortunately out of time. I do want to give each of my guests about a minute for any closing thoughts. Charles, you want to go first? You're muted, Charles.
Thanks. I know you don't want to get into it too much, but the last caller's comment gives me a chance to use one of my favorite quotes from my favorite show, The West Wing, which is, education is everything. We don't need little changes. We need gigantic, monumental changes. Schools should be palaces. Schools should be incredibly expensive for government and absolutely free of charge to its citizens, just like national defense. I think at its core, when we talk about education, what we're talking about is a battle over scarce resources. We need to fix the resources part, and that'll help fix the problem. Everyone should be entitled to an incredibly great world-class education. There shouldn't be battles over who gets to get into the quote-unquote good school. They should all be great schools. And with that, I will bring it back to where you think where I think you wanted me to go. You know, so as Mark said, I came on tonight, and we've heard some of the good things that are out there and some of the bad things, but I want to keep it positive, if possible. And I can only speak for San Mateo County because that's what I know. But I think part of how we pull ourselves out of what's going on is to continue to be good role models for the rest of the state and the country. You know, do things the San Mateo way. Former San Mateo Mayor John Lee, who's passed away a number of years ago, was fond of saying often, we can disagree without being disagreeable. And I think that getting to the crux of some of the issues we were going to talk about tonight, at least in terms of political discourse and how to get things done and how to move forward from some of these problems, that's been increasingly missing in our political discourse nationwide and even sometimes locally. Luckily, here in San Mateo County, things are still fairly civil, although we did have someone who addressed a public transit board and sister agency over the break, threatened some violence or seemed to threaten some violence and ended up having to be dealt with by law enforcement. And we also have folks who do send some really scary emails. But for the most part, things are pretty quiet here. I can't believe Mark didn't say it, but I will. Tom Lantos had a famous quote, which was the peninsula, and I'll get it a little wrong, I'm sure, but the peninsula is a hotbed of civil unrest. I want to offer a recent anecdote. I serve on the Caltrain Board of Directors, and right now we're embroiled in some extremely tense discussions about the future of the organization and SamTran's role as the managing agency. And there are very diverse opinions about what we should be doing, and we argue a lot. Nonetheless, last week we reorganized and had a succession plan normally and without any problems. So there's hope.
Mark, take about 30 seconds to a minute.
Okay, there's just a couple of points I'd make. One is, since we're talking about schools, I would love for civics to be taught again. When I was in eighth grade here in California, to graduate from the eighth grade, you had to pass something called the constitutional test, which was basically about the entire structure of the federal government. You had to memorize all the cabinet members, not just their positions. I think that there's something lacking that doesn't contribute to a generalized understanding of what government can or should be doing. The second issue I'd raise is one of greater concern, which is the news media is just in a lot of trouble. You know, for decades, centuries, publishers knew how to make money off of advertising. They still don't know how to make money off of content, partly because it would require them to pay reporters better. And I know publishers don't like to do that. But what I'm hoping is that we're done. Okay, what I'm hoping is that people will become better at discerning information that they're taking in and that they'll go ahead and read things that don't necessarily affirm their own worldview.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Our guest tonight has been District Attorney Jeff Rosen of Santa Clara County, attorney and former mayor of Belmont, Charles Stone, and political writer Mark Simon, my co-host, Dean Johnson. Tonight's show was produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. Next week, we hope to conclude our discussion on Have the Guardrails Come Off. Thanks to my co-host, Dean Johnson, and our guests for joining us, and especially our thanks to all of you for listening in. And at the controls, returning at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. Be safe. Have a good night.